Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Sometimes it's the things that go unsaid in a relationship that are the most important. Andrea Jarrell found that out not long after moving to Maine with her husband. She writes about it in her essay, A Measure of Desire. It's read by Kim Dickens from Fear the Walking Dead.
We moved from Los Angeles to Maine with 4 years of sobriety under our belts, a 2-year-old daughter and another baby on the way. The sobriety was my husband's. He'd been offered a job in Camden, and I was ready to leave mine. I hoped a simpler life would save us from further dangers that can creep into relationships, serpents in the grass like infidelity, boredom, debt. We arrived that fall at our blue cape-style house with the dormer windows I'd always wished for as a child. That first winter, we skated on frozen Maguntacook Lake. We were assured there was no danger of falling through, despite how the ice popped like gunfire as the whole town, or so it seemed, skated in circles. By Christmas, we placed single candles in each window instead of stringing colored lights the way we would have back in L.A., and I gave birth in an ice storm. My Californian mother, hurt that we had taken her grandchildren across the country, moved to New York City to be the urbanite she'd always dreamed of being. We began to make the 6-hour drive to see her. On one such visit, as she and I walked up Madison Avenue, I asked, "What I want to know is how people go without sex." "They eat a lot," she said with a smirk before stopping at Valentino to check out a pair of black suede pumps in the window. I might have said, "You don't." My parents had divorced earlier than most, when I was just 6, but by the time I hit puberty, my friends' parents were divorcing as well. Yet their mothers and fathers soon found new partners, while my beautiful mother continued standing alone. But in truth, I didn't know any more about her sex life than she knew about mine. Surely my handsome husband and I must have sex all the time. We had the babies to prove it. How could she know that sobriety, with all its wonders, had also brought an end to a kind of closeness only sex can bring? After my husband quit drinking, we had retreated to our corners, handling each other cautiously. It was like when a doctor in an old movie removes bandages from a patient's wounded eyes and everyone waits with bated breath to learn if the hero will ever see again. In Los Angeles, with my marketing job and city suits, I thought I was whole, waiting for him to get better. But in Maine, my husband quickly became more of an ideal than I had imagined possible. Gone was the lanky kid I'd married, the lighthearted guy who'd always wanted me. In his place was a quiet, broad-shouldered man with a strong jaw and blue eyes, a man women turned to watch as he walked down the street. I realized I was waiting for my increasingly handsome husband with his newly sober eyes to want me with the same abandon he once had, because that's what sex had always been for me, a measure of my desirability. If I was no longer desirable, then it was only a matter of time before I would be left standing alone like my mother. In my new L.L. Bean sweaters and loafers, I began to feel around in the darkness of our relationship, wondering if my husband was still there, wondering what kind of job I would get if he left me and knowing that if he did, I would end up living with my mother. The more frightened of that possibility I became, the more I began to see them, my replacements. I spotted these women the way my small son and I hunted through his iSpy books for a key, a silvery fish, and a Christmas tree. Sometimes we stared and stared, unable to see the hidden objects. Other times, a neon arrow might as well have been pointing the way. Surely such an arrow directed me to the woman in the supermarket. I can see her now, even today. It was our third main winter, not the pretty part leading up to Christmas, but the dreary aftermath. Pushing my cart past a display of scraggly poinsettias, I noticed her immediately. She was weighing snow peas, watching the scale's arrow flick near the pound mark as she tossed handfuls. She must have felt me watching her. "I can't get my kids to eat them," I said to explain my staring. "What's your secret?" "A little sugar and butter." I saw her in my kitchen then, standing at the stove in thick wool socks, sleeves pushed up. As she sautéed the peas, she reached to the cupboard for the sugar, knowing just where everything was. Before I pushed my cart away, I thanked her. Her shell-thin nostrils drew up along with her generous smile. That was a smile he could love. I forced myself to imagine her as my children's mother, their brown hair matching hers. My impatience, insecurity, and red hair gone from their lives, a fluke of nature corrected. I never told anyone how I tortured myself choosing second wife possibilities for my husband, how I marveled at the riches shimmering in women all around me. Closest I came was on a walk with my new friend Annie. She was older than me, with teenage daughters and a marriage I admired. We had taken to walking a 3-mile loop almost every day, past pine-covered hills and around the rocky edge of the ocean. Waves crashing nearby compelled non-trivial topics of conversation. I told her that when my husband was away, I lay awake at night wondering how to escape the house if someone broke in or fire broke out. I saw myself fashioning a rope from sheets, my babies clinging to me as we climbed out the dormer windows. I told her how my daughter was at an age when she just wanted daddy, how one night she'd even give me a little push away. Of my daughter's rejection, my friend said, "You shouldn't leave. You are the mother." She said mother like it started with a capital M. She said it to free me to be mother, not child. And when I told her about waiting for my husband's desire, she said, "What about your desire? Don't you deserve sex?" I considered this as if being asked to consider a new religion. In the weeks that followed, I toyed with my own desire. I noticed the tight pecs and the chin stubble on the bag boy at the grocery store. I inhaled my handsome optometrist's minty breath in the darkened exam room. I scandalized myself when a friend's husband lifted his arms, his shirt rising as he did, my eyes traveling from the waistband of his jeans up the trail of dark hair to his navel. And then I claimed my yearning. In the darkness of our room, I reached for my husband. At first, shyness lingered, but I did not hold back. Surprised, he kissed me with slightly opened lips. His fingers scanned my body with even more eagerness than I remembered. I wrapped my arms around him, showing how I wanted him, even though I thought a younger, nicer wife was what he deserved. Who knew that was all it took to be happy again? Later, I would learn he'd always relied on the balm of alcohol to face his desires. But my wanting him with such abandon changed that. I had ginned up courage for the both of us. The next morning at the Y, my swim goggles hanging around my neck, I chose out of habit the woman dressing next to me, As I busied myself with folding clothes, tucking them into my locker, I made myself jealous, wondering how my husband would find her body. If his hands would have more desire for her. But then I stuffed my long hair into my swim cap, my thoughts secret inside my head. With my husband's touch of the night before still humming on my skin, I turned from that woman in the locker room the same way my husband had once turned from drink. I can't tell you the precise moment I began to believe that my mother's life would not be mine after all, or exactly when I stopped looking for my replacement to reveal herself and take away all I had ever wanted. But I know it was in Maine, before we became city people again, before we moved on to our next adventure. I know it was where we skated on a frozen lake without falling through and dived into its liquid depths when the leafy summer arrived. I know it was there that I finally realized my husband, my babies, and those dormer windows were truly mine.
That's Kim Dickens reading Andrea Jarrell's piece, A Measure of Desire. We'll catch up with Andrea after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Andrea Jarrell grew up the daughter of an alcoholic and had a lot of alcoholism in her family. She says she thought she'd left that behind when she got married.
When I met my husband, he just seemed like this amazing person, dream come true. I had no idea he was an alcoholic. He was a secret drinker. And it was 5 days before our first wedding anniversary when he said, you know, I really need to go to AA. And I was in shock and actually very resentful for a few months until I started getting help for myself. You know, addiction and alcoholism impacts everybody in the family. And so I needed help for dealing with not only his alcoholism, but the alcoholism I had grown up with. And it's actually, I mean, it sounds crazy to say, but it's actually been an amazing gift in our marriage.
Andrea says that now she and her husband have the tools to get through difficult times. And she's also moved past some of her own personal challenges, like her habit of seeing second wives for her husband everywhere.
I knew all the things that were going on inside me, the insecurities that I had, whether that was about my relationship or about being a new mother, about living in this new place without my support network, without the job that I had left behind in Los Angeles. Then I'm looking at other women and thinking, wow, she's really got it all together.
Andrea's husband never imagined what she'd been thinking until he read her Modern Love piece.
I mean, he was just, that's crazy. You know, why would you do that? And plus, you know, he's telling me that I'm attractive and talented and a good mother and all the things that I was worried about. you know, part of the reason that I was doing this is I really saw how he had grown in sobriety and what a great father he is, you know, and I was striving to live up to that.
Now, Andrea says that her marriage is very different than what it was so long ago in Maine.
We were newly married, you know, within the first decade of our marriage, and now we've been married for 25 years. And also, our children were small, and they're both grown and out of the house at this point. And what's been really fun, actually, is that our marriage has just, and our relationship has just continued to grow. And we, of course, were sad, wistful, when our children went off to college, but we are excited about this new phase of our life together. And yeah, and we're just having really more fun than ever.
Andrea Jarrell. She and her husband live in Washington, D.C., and she's the author of a memoir called I'm the One Who Got Away. There's more after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Daniel Jones is the editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times.
I think what comes through in Andrea's essay is how our past contributes to desire and what we lacked in our childhood. You know, if our parents divorced and we grew up with an absent father, how that affects what we then seek out in a partner, not on a conscious level, on a deeply buried level. Like this is, we need to replace that person that we lost. I just thought it was a sort of a wonderfully meditative essay on all of those complexities and just didn't shy away from any of them.
And here's Kim Dickens.
It resonates with how vulnerable it is to love and to stay open. And it just feels so personal. And the vulnerability of it, I think, was so beautiful.
Thanks again to Kim for reading this week's piece. You can see her in Fear the Walking Dead. Next week, Saoirse Ronan.
I thought it must not have really been love. How could the doctor love me when I didn't understand him? And if I could not understand him or know him completely, how could I love him back?
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, Caitlin O'Keefe, John Perotti, and Amory Sievertson. Additional sound design by Paul Vikas. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.